Blog Talk Radio.
To an astounding future that lies ahead, one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting upon the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and I'm working the board here on the virtual studio, trying to bring on Stephen and our guest.
I am here, Phil.
Oh, Stephen, you're here with me? What about our guest? We're working
PJ,
on...
Has PJ Manning joined us?
Okay, PJ is trying to dial in and having a little bit of trouble. We're having our glitch of the day here today. Actually, it says she's in the queue. So, let's see, if I do this, PJ, are you there?
I'm there. Can you hear me now?
Oh, yes. Oh, good. Okay. We're all together. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. It's great to be here.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you with us, and I was just, Steve and I were just discussing the fact that we have a tradition here at The World Transformed. We call it the glitch of the week. And sometimes they're bigger, sometimes they're smaller, sometimes they're just fun little things, and then sometimes they're catastrophic. This is what I would call just a little series of fun things right at the beginning of the show. I had some trouble with Skype, and then we had just a little bit of trouble with the board, but gosh, we're all here, and we've got a great topic tonight, so I'm super excited about the show. Stephen, how are you this evening?
I'm doing great, Phil. Doing real good. So, like you said, we got a great topic. So let's get into it. PJ, how are you doing?
Oh, very well, thanks, guys.
Awesome.
Well, it's super fantastic that we have you on as you were going to be our first guest of the year, and then somebody slipped in ahead of you.
I have no problem with that.
you're our second guest this year, and you've been on so many times. I'm not going to read the whole intro, if that's okay. Let me give the short version. PJ is amazing. Okay, there.
I'll take it. Thank you.
That's my introduction, and anyone who has the least doubt of that, just stay tuned. Because we're gonna demonstrate that through the discussion we're gonna have this evening. So, it's been a while since we spoke. How were the holidays? You getting getting the new year off to a good start? All that sort of thing.
A lot of stuff going on. So yes, it's all good, and life is moving forward.
All right. Well, we're gonna get into some of the interesting things you've been up to, and some of the interesting things that have been going on with you a little bit later in the program. But we thought we would start with a topic of mutual interest, and that has certainly had a lot of attention nationally and globally over the past couple of weeks. And that, of course, is the passing of David Bowie, and such an important iconic figure in so many ways. And, PJ, when I saw that you had posted about what an influence he had been on you and your writing, I thought, well, you know what, let's do a show talking about David Bowie. Everyone's been talking about, the impact that he's had in so many different areas. And really, he's been a tremendously influential figure in science fiction, in how we think about the future, as well as in popular culture and in art and in so many other ways. So I thought we'd just spend a little bit of time, you know, Stephen, we do this every now and then. We just kind of geek out. We go fanboy on this show,
yep.
And I thought we would do that for David Bowie here tonight. Certainly a worthy figure for that. So let's talk some David Bowie this evening. Stephen, or PJ, let me just start with you. Is that appropriate? Is he a guy we should be talking about on a show like The World Transformed?
Oh, absolutely. What made Bowie such a potent figure in 20th century music was twofold for me. One was he embraced the outsider, the freak, the alien in all of us. Anyone who perceived themselves as being outside the norm could look at Bowie in his many manifestations and find themselves in the stories and in the characters he created. And several of those characters were of a futuristic bent, like Ziggy Stardust or Major Tom. And what was wonderful about those characters and the songs that they portrayed was he, and you, and we've talked about how important I think empathy and storytelling is, especially in the course of the history of science fiction.
Right.
The other, the alien, the monster, started out as this thing of fear and evolved through time into becoming the hero. And Bowie was one of the earliest musicians to embrace the other, the alien, as hero. And in doing so, created not just incredible empathy for the idea of aliens among us, but also really tapped into that zeitgeist of 70s young people who felt like the world was not made for them.
Right.
They didn't fit. They were uncomfortable. And, you know, let's face it, it was a weird time in the world. He really captured that essence and moved the persona of the alien forward in popular culture.
And you know,
I wonder.
Go ahead,
PJ. I wonder if we would have had E.T. without Ziggy.
That's an excellent question, and you could argue there were other aspects of the culture that were embracing the alien or the Starman, if you will.
Right.
But certainly, it made it a lot easier. Absolutely. Yep. Ziggy made E.T. a lot easier.
Yeah.
But you think about, the idea of making the alien the hero. In a lot of ways, he made, I called the show Falling to Earth because I was such a big fan in college of the movie The Man Who Fell to Earth, which
yes.
starred David Bowie, and just watched it again this weekend because I was thinking, hey, I want to talk about that. And I couldn't remember it, you know. It's like I remembered scenes from it, but I couldn't quite remember the story. And the thing that struck me on viewing it again, all these years later, is that it's not just the alien as hero. It's almost like alienness as hero, alienation almost as hero. The amazing performance that he had in that movie. I was reading the Roger Ebert review of it, and he said it was really the role that David Bowie was born to play, right? This
yeah.
The alien pretending to be a human but not trying all that hard or not doing a particularly good job or, you know, however you want to describe what he's doing there, really not fitting in at all. And it's this back and forth between these amazingly connected moments you see in these scenes between him and Candy Clark and Rip Torn, and then this juxtaposition of these scenes where they're both apparently talking about the same thing, and it's like it's not the same thing. We don't know what Tommy or Thomas or Tom is thinking at all, because he is just completely not one of us. You know, he doesn't look it. He doesn't move like us. He doesn't act like us, and ultimately, he doesn't think like us. And I think it conveyed the idea of being alien much more persuasively than, you know, even the best CGI can today, right? because you felt
Absolutely.
It. You know, it's like you feel this this difference between these people. Just a weird movie, too, by the way. I mean, just looking back, I'm in awe that a movie like that. There was a time that movies like that got made. You know what I mean? That you could commercially make a movie that goes in the directions it goes in and has the scenes in it that it has. I hope we see more of that. You know, we got people making movies on their smartphones and stuff these days. I'd really like to see more of that kind of stuff, because it's great to have that as kind of a touchstone, kind of a reference point. That both that performance and just kind of what he did with it later. And my understanding is that the character he plays in that one, Thomas Jerome Newton, has been referenced in subsequent albums. I'm not too up on some of David Bowie's latest music, and in fact, is a character. He appears in this last album that he just released. That in some ways, the final album is sort of a sequel to The Man Who Fell to Earth. Do you know? Are you up on that, PJ? Do you know anything about that?
Well, the video Black Star itself definitely has imagery that both harks back to Major Tom and to The Man Who Fell to Earth, as well as some of the musical lyrics. They're definitely echoes. He's trying to wrap up his legacy in Black Star, and this is such a huge part of his legacy. The astronaut, the alien, the star traveler, the starman.
Absolutely.
Awesome.
Well, and when you take it back to Space Oddity, to Major Tom, the thing that always struck me about that song, was just the raw emotion of it, you know. We don't quite know what's happening to him, and I don't know, or maybe we do, and maybe I just have always missed the whole point of the song. But he's having a very transcendent experience out in space, and it's over and above, obviously, all the superficial things that we think about astronauts. You know, the papers want to know whose shirt you wear, and you know,
exactly.
You've made the grade. And all that kind of stuff, but he's out there and experiencing something, and what he's experiencing is so profound that he just disappears. Right? He's just goodbye.
But it's basically his. He obviously is harking back in the title to 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Yes.
And it's his version of that. What is, again, for him? What is the deeply personal experience? What is the empathy creating moment? You know, we look at these astronauts as heroes, and they go out and they do this amazing thing, and they come back. Well, what if you were the astronaut who didn't come back?
Right.
And you're having this experience. What would that be like? And that's what he's really connecting you to.
Yeah. And,
a complete separation from all of humanity.
Absolutely.
You know?
And what I found so interesting is in his sequel, Ashes to Ashes, which is the part two of the Major Tom for him, because there are other artists who also did Major Tom songs, but his part two, he ties it much more directly into his personal experiences of drug addiction. So you could interpret the song as an astronaut, but you could also interpret the song as an addict.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about Bowie, is that he has two, three, sometimes four layers of meaning and ambiguity, and you bring to it your own experience, and, you know, that's what made him a genius.
And those themes come out in Man Who Fell to Earth, too, you know. I mean,
absolutely.
Just the amazing thing about this movie, you know. You could never make a movie like this today, right? So the alien comes to Earth. He's got to save his planet. He's got to build a starship. And I'm sorry to spoil it for anyone who's never seen it, but it doesn't really spoil a thing. The plot doesn't matter. It really doesn't. Okay, so his home planet is dying of thirst, basically. They've had a huge drought. So he's come to Earth. He's brought all this technological secrets. He starts a company. He's going to build a starship and bring water back to Earth. So what happens is that he gets sidetracked. You know, he has an affair. He gets addicted to TV. He gets addicted to gin and tonics. You know what I mean? Just like,
yes.
You know, it's a serious part of the story that this guy gets, you know, overcome with booze addiction. I mean, it's kind of really where the story takes you. And it so humanizes him, even though he's not a humanizable character because he is so different. And yet, you empathize with him all the way. In fact, in some ways, you empathize with him more than you do anyone else in the movie, even though they're all human and he's the odd one.
That was his magic trick. It was being the oddest person in any situation, and yet his humanity and the thing that you could empathize with him just came through absolutely everything he did.
Yeah, it really showed. Yeah, and there have been other things that he's been in that aren't necessarily genre, not science fiction, but still conveyed some of that same kind of idea. And I don't know if you saw this clip that's been going around. It was from the Ricky Gervais series on HBO, Extras.
I didn't see him in it. No, I love that show.
it's such a wonderful moment in Extras. I don't know if you watched that show at all, but Ricky Gervais is he's this down on his luck actor who finally gets his big hit TV series in the UK, but it's this real schlocky, formulaic, pandering to the lowest common denominator thing, and so he's very happy to finally be a big successful actor, but he lives with the guilt that he's not been true to his art and all that kind of stuff. And there's this scene where he's at a party and he meets David Bowie, and David Bowie is playing himself. The celebrities always play themselves in these shows. And Gervais tells him, actually David Bowie asks him, "Well, so how are things are going?" And he immediately goes into the whole spiel. "Well, I've got this series, but the network has kind of stepped in, and we kind of pandered to the lowest common denominator, and everything I just said, right?" He just immediately lays out this whole sad set of excuses. And David Bowie is sitting at the piano, and he goes, "Oh, I see." And he just starts singing this song about Ricky Gervais making excuses for himself and how pathetic he is. It's just one of the funniest things. It's one of the highlights. It was a really funny series anyway. One of the highlights of the whole series for me was, and everybody starts joining in, pretty soon by the end, the whole party's joining in, and now Ricky Gervais is a little sad, fat man with a pug nose, and it's just, it's hilarious. And he did, he did a lot of stuff like that, but that one kind of turned it around, right? He laid the alienation on somebody else for once.
Right, exactly.
was the insider, and he put that whole alien thing on somebody else. It was just tremendously effective. Well, what else can we say about David Bowie? It's not just, I think, the music, although the music was tremendously important. He's a real pioneer in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. He really could foresee technological change and how it would affect the creation and production of music, how it might affect commerce. When he came up with, some things didn't succeed, like his Bowie bonds, where he was actually selling a piece of future profits and royalties of his creative work, but it was a very interesting attempt to create a new financial model. He also foresaw the shift in the music industry, that basically people like himself and anyone coming up after them were going to have enormous difficulties selling music. That
right.
Music, while you could sell it easily, he believed it would be like water. There's a great quote, "Music itself is going to become like running water or electricity." Because it would be incredibly easy to have, but incredibly difficult to make money from.
Right.
And now you look at the artists' complaints working with Spotify and iTunes and other companies like that, where the lion's share is going to the distributors and very little is going to the artists. And he basically not only foresaw that, he said, "Guys, you got to go back out touring. That they cannot take away from you."
Yeah, exactly.
And he saw that 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's exactly right. It is like water. I think about, I subscribe to the cloud version of iTunes, so I can listen to anything, anytime. But what am I paying for that? Like $10 a month? That's way less than my water bill, right? So the model is like water, but it's interesting how sort of undervalued music has become in that sense. And we part of the downside to the abundance economy and everything being free economy is our expectation of freeness. You know, when it comes to things like music, is definitely played into the kinds of changes he was talking about. I want to swing it back to the Bowie bonds just for a minute, because I think that's a huge innovation that he was behind. And although there's a perception that those were kind of a bust, in fact, initially at least, they were highly successful. And my understanding is that they ended up okay. They at one point got rated down close to junk bond status, but by the time the bond term ended, people had come out fairly all right with them. But be that as it may, whether they were, you know, a good investment or not, and I really couldn't say, because I've just, you know, read about it. The idea of it has stuck, right? And he was first person ever to do anything like that. Not only the first person ever to, you know, we talk about, in marketing, you talk about this all the time, you know, making yourself into a brand, right? This guy literally did it, okay? I mean, he literally, you know, turned his body of work, the intellectual property around it, into a, you know, its own brand, its own business, and marketed it in a way completely different than anyone had ever done before. But now the model exists, and lots of others are following suit. I think that was a tremendously trailblazing thing that he did. And I remember, when did that happen? It was mid '90s, is that right, or was it
1997? It's almost 20 years ago that he created these IP-based financial instruments, which is incredible, absolutely incredible, because they do exist. You can now buy into these streams of royalty payments, future royalty payments in the film business and all kinds of businesses. You're basically
he was
putting a bet on how well they're going to do.
He was kickstarting himself before there was Kickstarter, in a way.
Yeah. He was.
Yeah.
And you know, the thing is, I remember when that was announced, thinking about that, because I've always liked David Bowie, and I remember thinking, I was going, well, that's just too much. I don't know what the hell, you know, that's a publicity stunt. Really, it's hard to imagine how different the world is 20 years later. But I thought that sounded like the craziest thing I'd ever heard. Or like, you know, that's a great, you know, way for him to promote his albums or whatever. But, you know, there's not really a business there. And now I look at it and I say, well, yeah, actually all business will be that eventually. And, you
exactly.
know, this is one of the first people ever to recognize it and to really make it happen. It's just an astounding thing. Other things he did, too, you know, he was an artist. My friend Matt Bargel has been loading Facebook with images of David Bowie's paintings, which I didn't even know he painted. He did these amazing paintings, which, you know, was just this one facet of all these things he did. The thing I always think about is, you remember the movie This Is Spinal Tap?
Oh, one of my favorites.
I love that movie so much. And one of the things that's so endearing about the rock stars in This Is Spinal Tap, these would-be rock stars, you know, has-been rock stars, is just their sheer pretentiousness and, you know, their deep felt need to present themselves as like some kind of great intellectual, you know, people, right? That they're really deep and that, you know, they really understand things and they've got this spiritual dimension to them and they're well-read and everything. And of course they're idiots, right? I mean, you know, they keep giving themselves away that they're not that. And I always thought it was such a, you know, mean, but kind of right on the money assessment of so many people in that industry, you know, that you actually do see these blowhards left and right all the time. But I remember even the first time I saw it, one of the things I thought was, yeah, but not David Bowie, right? He actually is, you know, he really is smart, you know? I mean, he's not faking it, you know, he's not putting on an act. Definitely he was putting on a persona, but he was putting on a persona kind of driven by his intelligence, and it was, you know, his whole thing was this work of art he was doing rather than this, I don't even know how to describe the difference between the two things I'm talking about, but he definitely stands apart, I would say, from even, you know, his own generation and any other generation of artists coming up at that time, and definitely paved the way for a lot of them.
Absolutely.
You know, you know, the movie that stands out in my mind of his is Labyrinth.
Mm.
You know, in a movie populated by Jim Henson's creatures, he was the weirdest thing there was in the movie. Yeah. And just his ability to do that. I mean, it's just it was incredible. I love that movie. It's just a deeply strange artifact of its time. I think, like The Man Who Fell to Earth, it'd be difficult for something like Labyrinth to be made today. It's cool that way. One of my favorite movies, recent movies, is this Prestige. Y'all remember his little part in that movie?
Oh yes, because I'm a Tesla fan.
He played Nikolai Tesla, right, in the Prestige?
Oh yeah, and he looks nothing like Tesla at all, not even a little bit. And he embodied that character so much. I mean, it seemed to me he almost stole the movie in the just a few scenes that he had, because you know he was just, you know, he was a wizard in a way. You know, they went beyond, you know, him being just an inventor. You know, he was magic in a way, and that was an interesting portrayal of Tesla. You know, fictional of course, but it was who else could have done that? I'm not sure who they would have gotten other than David Bowie to bring that
play that version of Tesla. He was absolutely
that's
perfect.
Right.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah, I wasn't even thinking about that movie when I was thinking about his body of work, but it's true. That's such a great, just a few scenes he's in too, right? Probably not even 5 minutes on screen total. Yeah, yeah, he really does make that movie. And the other one is The Hunger, which
yes, the fodder of many during my period, many college boy fantasies.
Well, yeah. that movie is groundbreaking in many ways, but you know, of all of his big, you know, starring roles, probably the one that's closest to something that you could make something commercially similar to today, right? I mean, you know, oddly enough, that might be his most mainstream movie, if that's if that even makes
sense. Yeah, I would actually. It's a very accurate assessment. That's very interesting.
Yeah, you know, and yet, who better to play a vampire, right? I mean, it was
and because he makes that vampire so damn interesting.
Right, yeah, exactly.
But not sparkly, so, you know, we have that.
He was not sparkly.
I'm so glad it's not sparkly.
Which is not to say he could sparkle when he wanted to, but he did
not.
Oh,
there's no one
true.
More sparkly
Ziggy
when he chose to sparkle, yes.
But only when he chose to. Yeah, just a tremendous impact. I you know, down to like this very odd thing that happened on a Bing Crosby Christmas special in like 1971, 72 of Bing Crosby and David Bowie singing The Little Drummer Boy together has actually become part of the canon of like popular Christmas music, which is just bizarre beyond words. And I remember, Steve, we've been talking about these iconic TV things that happened in the 70s. We were talking about the Star Wars holiday special a couple weeks ago, which I never saw when it happened. But I remember watching that Bing Crosby special. And I remember it's like, oh, wow, David Bowie and Bing Crosby are singing a song together, thinking
yeah,
how utterly bizarre that was and how well it worked at the same time. You know, it was just
well, he had enormous respect for the people who came before him. He may have been a trailblazer, but he was always harking back to more traditional crooners. And apparently his mother adored Bing Crosby, so that's why he did it.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
That's nice. That's nice.
That makes it even better. He did it because his mom was a Bing Crosby fan.
That
reminds me of Christopher Walken in a way. You know, he did that dance number on Saturday Night Live for his mom because he always plays psychos, and she would never be able to watch it. And so, this is for you.
Here, I'll do it next.
Oh, gosh.
That's amazing. What else can we say about David Bowie? You know, I look at how popular music has progressed, or you know what's occurred with it over the last few decades, and definitely You can see the influence that he had throughout the 80s and the 90s and, you know, even today. Just the whole idea of having, you know, this distinct persona. There were people at the time who were kind of trying, experimenting with doing things like that, like Alice Cooper and, you know, people like that. But today, you know, even today you've got people like Lady Gaga. It's like, well, could you have Lady Gaga if you hadn't had David Bowie, right?
Not at all. Absolutely. No. He was the guy who invented reinvention. He's the guy who invented the changing personas that adapted to the zeitgeist of the period. And you couldn't have Madonna, you couldn't have Lady Gaga, you couldn't have a lot of performers if he hadn't blazed that trail and made it clear
he just kept
on making himself relevant.
Yeah. Even Peter Gabriel kind of, you know, he had his persona and his Gabriel verse, you know, where everything was kind of connected. It has to be some influence there.
Yeah, I think so. Or Sting, you know. I think there's a couple of generations now of artists who really owe something to his legacy. But on top of that, the thing is, he invented a persona, but also he had an amazing voice, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was an incredibly talented musician. So it's like it wasn't just a guy putting on a costume or dressing up like a woman or doing whatever weird thing he was doing at the time. It was a really talented musician doing those things. You know, I think it makes makes a huge difference, because anybody can, be gimmicky, right? But it was never gimmicky with him. He was really carrying out some work of art.
If it was a gimmick, it was always in service of a goal that, you know.
Exactly.
You know, that he was bringing about. So, yeah, awesome.
Yeah.
It was a complete artistic expression. I mean, that's the thing, is every one of these personas evolved. He had, with the music and the art and the costume and his physical presentation, all of it was a complete artistic package. And that's the rarity that even the Madonnas and the Gagas and et cetera have never quite reached that peak. No one has ever created the complete artistic expression like he did.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just an amazing legacy. We'll never see his like again, but how fortunate we are that we live in a world that had him in it, I think is really about all you can say.
Well, and honestly, I could never have written my books without him, so there you go.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. I know that you mentioned that on Facebook. How has David Bowie influenced your work as a novelist?
Well, first of all, as I mentioned at the beginning, his incredible ability to create empathy for something that might seem, someone who might seem alien or freakish or the other. But specifically, because my protagonist thinks in terms of music, he problem solves in terms of music, I listen to a lot of music, and probably my favorite Bowie song is Space Oddity. And it makes sense, given my interests and my predilections. Of course, my hero ends up becoming Major Tom in a different way, but he becomes Major Tom, and to the point of calling himself that. So in the sequels, he is Major Tom, and I get to have fun with the Major Tom legacy, not just in Ashes to Ashes, but in the other songs, like Peter Schilling or KIA, and their depictions of what happened to Major Tom, as well as obviously other music. But yeah, I could never have written Revolution if it hadn't been for David Bowie.
Well, there you go. You know, your books would be different. We'd be living in a very different world if it weren't for David Bowie. The future would be unfolding differently, I think, without him.
That our world is the right amount of different, thanks to David Bowie.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. Well,
I like that.
Now, EJ, you've got us looking forward to the next book, and we're going to be, you know, we're going to be looking for the Major Tom stuff all the more, right? I'd actually forgotten about the Major Tom connection in Revolution, and now that's yet to, you know, that's another layer for us to explore in the next book. So speaking of the next book, when are we going to see that?
Sometime next year. Identity will be coming out in 2017.
Now, so have you done the title the same way? Is it an I in parentheses and then Identity?
It's an ID in parentheses, so it's ID Entity.
And then Entity, oh yeah.
Entity.
See, that works.
And and then book three is Conscience, so the CON is in parentheses, so it's Conscience.
Conscience, very cool. Oh, that's so cool. Wow. So how long will we be waiting for Conscience after Identity?
Oh, at least another year after that, at least. Yeah. The good thing is that come fall, I'll have both children in college, and it will be a much quieter house.
That will help, yeah, for sure. Well, you know, I'm skipping around with topics here, but since we're on your book, let's talk a little bit about how excited we are and congratulations on Revolution being nominated for the Philip K. Dick Award.
Thank you so much, guys. I got to tell you, I was stunned.
Well, I'm not the least bit surprised. Stephen, are you?
It was, I was about to jump in and just say, the book is that good. PJ, I know, you know, it's, you know, as the author, you might be too close to realize how good it is, but maybe, you know, maybe.
No,
maybe
trust me, I don't know.
And, you know, I suspect that you wouldn't have brought out a book unless you thought it was excellent, but we think it's excellent too. And it's just that good, and we're not surprised. So we wish you the
best.
Thank
you.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, guys.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I think obviously it's a great honor anytime you get nominated for something like that. But I have to say, if I were a science fiction writer, this would be the one I'd want to be nominated for. Okay, I gotta say that the award name for Philip K. Dick is just awesome. You know, I mean,
yeah, he's pretty much the coolest dude.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, if you get an award named after, I mean, you know, the Hugo's after Hugo Gernsback, great. You know, that's awesome.
Right.
You know, or if, you know, there's a Robert A. Heinlein prize of some kind, I believe, and, you know, that would be incredibly awesome, too. But Philip K. Dick is just, you know, he's the guy. I mean,
well, and also, I was laughing, just talking to my husband about it just today, in fact, and saying, yeah, kind of, in a weird way, it's kind of appropriate because of how trippy my book gets. It's definitely kind
right.
of
yeah.
a head trip, drug trip, whatever. So it was like, yeah, okay,
yeah.
I kind of get it.
Yeah.
It's appropriate for Philip K. Dick.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I think he would have liked your book. I really did.
I think he would have too. Well, his thing, his theme throughout all of his fiction is exploring different levels of reality. Right.
Yeah.
You know, it's just always bouncing back and forth between different levels of reality. And in your book, you know, you take a new tack on that, because truly to go into a new substrate is to enter a new level of reality in a completely different way. Right. I mean, in a way we haven't thought about. It's not just, you know, normally we see reality divided up into fiction or nonfiction, you know, actual perception and delusion. Right. Those
mm-hmm.
kinds of. And that's all true, you know, the way a child sees the world and the way a mature person sees the world. Those are all different levels of reality. But for sure, the perspective of a biological human being versus the perspective of a being whose consciousness is entirely within the cloud, you know, those are two distinct flavors of reality, right? I mean, it's two different kinds of reality, and it's a new way of dividing it up, and it's a whole new reality distinction to explore that you're you know, a whole new space you're getting to introduce us to.
Oh, absolutely, and even before he gets to that substrate, I'm fascinated by what happens when we start playing around with our brain and trying to, you know, take a healthy brain and applying therapies to it that would be therapeutic for a diminished cognitive capacity. If you start giving yourself, in essence, two parallel processors, what does that do to reality? That's got to do something.
Yeah,
you know, you've got all
absolutely.
This perception hitting you. What are you perceiving?
What does it mean?
Yeah,
yeah, it's so true. We, you know, we were talking about this last week. We were talking about you know, potential electronic and chemical ways of stimulating spiritual experiences, or like, you know, tapping into the brain and stimulating the pleasure centers and things like that. And you run into this, you know, there's really interesting questions about, well, was it a real spiritual experience? You know, is that really pleasure if you're having those kinds of things? And then you take it to that next level when the brain starts processing in ways that organically it never could have before, right? You're not just giving it impulses that it would have had anyway through different channels. You're truly introducing, you know, novel things into it. Reality starts to truly bifurcate at that point. And then when you move into the new substrate, it's gonna change all the greater. I guess the real challenge at that point for you as a writer is somehow keeping us empathetic with that entity as he evolves, right? Or keeping, you know,
absolutely. And I will tell you, it's a challenge. absolutely, because in some ways he's quite diminished.
Right.
I mean, spoiler alert. In some ways he will be quite diminished because he may not be a perfect replication of what he was as a biological creature.
Oh, interesting.
And what does that mean? And can you keep the reader empathizing with that? There are a whole host of challenges. And then what happens if he decides to download again into a human being?
Oh, wow. Now, is that
so,
a spoiler?
You know, you get to play all kinds of things.
All kinds of possibilities there. Well, what's interesting about that is that also then speaks to the possibility of eventually someday we'll see a purely artificial construct potentially downloading into a human body, and what will interactions with a being like that be? And then that kind of brings you back to the whole discussion about the alien and the other. And it's like, it's too bad we don't have David Bowie with us anymore to play that character, right?
Because I will tell you as a writer, you know, whenever you create something, you know, there's that one person. That one person you know who will never actually get to see the thing you created, but you really, 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 really wish they could.
Right.
And for me, it was David Bowie. I really, really wanted him to read my book someday. Because of all that, you know, because of that, the challenge of making these kinds of characters relatable and empathetic and someone you wanted to spend time with to understand.
Absolutely. I mean, ultimately that becomes, you know, I mean, finally, that's the challenge that everyone who writes fiction deals with, right? I mean, that's what you,
right, of course.
You talk about when you talk about the problem of empathy. But you really make it hard on yourself, PJ, when you... you know, when you take on these characters, right? I mean, it's like, it's hard enough, right? It's hard enough writing about somebody selling insurance and making that, you know, somebody you can sympathize with and understand their life and all that kind of thing. So, yeah, you've bitten off quite a bit. So I'm glad you're up for this award. We're also very glad to see that our good buddy Ramez Nam is up for it for Apex.
Exactly.
Which, you know, we still haven't
wonderful?
Had him on the show to talk about that. Can you believe that? We've got to have him on to talk about Apex. We're way behind. Now that he's up for this award, we'll have to do that. So, you know, we're pulling for both of you. We hope it's a tie between the two of you.
That would be perfect.
Although, I don't know if you saw on Facebook, Christine Peterson came in and said, nah, he's had his awards. It's PJ's turn. So, you know. That's,
bless your heart, man.
That would also be okay, I will say. That would also be okay. fine and dandy with us. So one of the things we wanted to talk about tonight before we run out of time is, so you've been talking to the young people about transhumanism here lately. Tell us about that experience.
So, yes, at Williams College, during their winter study period, the school has students take for a month, the month of January, a single class that is unusual in the scope of traditional college courses. And it can be anything from automotive repair to the history of skiing. my son did last year landscape photography, which he very much enjoyed. And this year, he decided to sign up for a class in Humanity 2.0.
Wow.
The professor, Dr. Grant Schofstall, is testing out this class because it appears he's getting ready to write a book.
What is he a professor of?
Is using the
normally,
class.
When he's not doing
Say again?
This. What is he a professor of normally when he's not doing this?
He's normally a professor of sociology.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
So he's taking the perspective of what are the threads in culture that encourage people towards something like transhumanism.
Right.
And his syllabus is actually quite fascinating. It's a lot of popular culture, a lot of movies you guys have talked about over the years, television shows, et cetera, as well as a good deal of both the greatest names in transhumanism, whether it's Max and Natasha Vita Moore or Kurzweil or James Hughes or whomever, their work, and then also the critiques of transhumanism, Catherine Hales and Francis Fukuyama, and so trying to balance both the desires and dreams of transhumanists with the criticisms of its place in culture.
Right.
So I came in and spent a class period with them discussing my personal experiences in transhumanism, because I come to it from a very different standpoint than the traditional thought leaders, in that I'm both coming from it from both a storytelling standpoint and also, quite frankly, from a marketing standpoint. When I was chairing what was the World Transhumanist Association, I had them rebrand their organization into Humanity Plus. I helped organize Convergence 08 with Christine Peterson to try to get all these futurists nonprofits together talking about these ideas. I helped James Clements start H Plus Magazine. I wanted to get the ideas out in a way that was the next step for transhumanist thought.
Right.
And, you know, to an extent, I think I succeeded. I also wanted them to understand that transhumanism was broader than the traditional readings, which are all now, when you think about it, all that stuff's a decade old.
Yeah.
You know, we've had a decade of global growth in interest in transhumanism. And with that global growth has come an incredible diversity, not just in the nations that where people come from or the interests that people have, but also not everyone's an immortalist. Not everyone is interested in cyborgs. Not everybody has their thing. You know, there's
right.
becoming the niching of transhumanism. And I find that really fascinating. And more interesting to me was that people studying it had no idea that was going on because there are no books about it.
Hmm, yeah.
We've had this enormous growth in the last 10 years, and it's gone relatively undocumented.
That's true. I mean, it's documented to some extent in blogs, and you know, it sort of is referenced kind of on the side, right, in social media, and people sort of know about it, but there's not been a tracking of that a marking of that as it occurs, and there really should be, because it's true. You know, I hadn't thought about that, but it's really true. Stuff, you know, the ideas have been percolating for well over a decade now. In some instances, you know, people have been talking about and thinking about these things, and there has been this tremendous impact. So where's the book going to come from? Are you going to provide it?
I first have to get through my my trilogy, please. But I would love
to write. Yeah.
I actually would love to write it because I find the new diversity of transhumanism fascinating, and incredibly important for the ideas to continue to grow and evolve. So that it was very exciting. What I also thought, frankly, was the most exciting thing was listening to the students' questions. They had excellent questions. About, well, they wanted to know about the place, the different aspects of society and their place in transhumanism. Some students were interested in the religious metaphor that is often used. How, for some transhumanists, this rapture of the nerds, that really is something that they look towards transhumanism for. Versus the people for whom that's not an issue, that's not actually their interest at all, why they're involved. They asked really great questions about the opinions on cloning, opinions on the use of genetic engineering, like CRISPR. They asked really insightful questions about how do transhumanists think? Where do they get these ideas from? How do they communicate them? I ended up asking questions back, and my biggest question was, based on what you've seen and read and heard so far, you know, what do you think? And I will tell you, based on the old materials that they're looking at, which again are, let's face it, in some cases, the only materials that exist.
Right.
It's not the most positive response. And I think that's a very important thing for the community to understand, that it's another reason why I think our message needs to evolve, that here's some of the brightest kids in America.
Mm-hmm.
And mind-boggling. I've gotten to meet many of them through my son. And, you know, these kids are just phenomenal. And they're taking this material, and they're not terribly impressed.
Interesting.
And yet, they were asking questions like, well, you know, if you were interested in STEM, what areas would you go into that you think the future
right.
is going to hold? You know, they're really interested in knowing where the future is going, no question. And they want to participate in it.
You know, one of the things that's really interesting that I'm hearing from you is that we've kind of crossed this important divide between is any of this real? Is any of this going to happen? This kind of you know, credulity gap that Kurzweil talks about, and now you've got people talking about, well, how do we deal with these things? What do we do with these things? Right? Rather than, will any of this happen? Definitely,
right.
You know, the question of where it's all going to end up. But, you know, these kids are talking about their reality, right? They're talking about the world that they see that they live in or will be living in, and they want to make sense of that, right? It's not just some really, you know, cool prospect for how things might turn out. You know, they're looking at their own lives, right?
Absolutely,
well,
and
no,
they're dealing with issues
of
scarcity and post-scarcity and climate change and economic inequality, and they're wondering how this all fits in.
Right.
Well, you think about it this way. You can, you know, when you first start dating somebody, you know, they're perfect in every way, and you see only the good things about them, right? We're on date number 12 or 13, right? I mean, we're a little further into this, and you can begin to see the outlines of what the problems are going to be, too, you know?
The honeymoon is over with transhumanism, huh?
Yeah. So I'm,
well, and that's certainly what the students seem to be honing in on, which is,
right.
you know, these ideas are well and good, but
right.
what does it really mean in reality?
Well, right. I mean, two of the most interesting movies of the last couple of years, Her from 2014 and Ex Machina from 2015, you know, just chock full of transhumanist ideas, but both movies are scary. I mean.
Yeah, they are, yeah.
This is downright scary.
Well, and there's a lot to be anxious about. Let's face it,
right.
You know, especially if you're just starting out in the world, trying to put a career together, you know, thinking about thinking about how all this is going to impact your life. You know, I'm glad that they're engaged in that way. Actually, I think the critique is probably overdue and will only help. It'll be interesting to see what kinds of ideas this kind of next wave of people interested in these things come up with, won't it?
I absolutely agree, and I think all the questions are needed to be asked. And the more questions that are asked, the better it will be.
There you go. Well, and how did you like doing it? Was it fun?
Oh, I loved it. I love young people, and I'm so always so curious to get inside their heads and try to understand what this next generation's up to.
Yeah.
What
are they
the kids
are
talking
they
about these days?
Crazy music they listen to and the way they off my lawn, you know. Although I will say this. I mean, it's glad that there are pockets of this emerging. I still think we got a long way to go as a society. I definitely, you know, when I read regular media or when I watch, God help us, like the presidential debates, I still think there is a huge room for the world to be informed about these things and to know more about what the possibilities are. I think that that we're just beginning really to explore and understand those. So, PJ, keep talking to people. I think you're a great person to have out there talking to the young people.
Well, thank you.
I'm
trying.
let me throw this out here because, you know, we know that these developments bring problems, but come on, we lost David Bowie, Alan Rickman, and Dan Haggerty to cancer, you know, in the last week, right? And, I mean, so hopefully the things that scare us are also the things that are going to solve some pretty damn scary things that we're dealing with now. So,
absolutely.
And there you have it. So we've got a lot to look forward to as well, Stephen. Thanks for getting us back on that page. And PJ, you know what? We've actually run out of time, but all I can say is it's always a quick hour talking to you. Let's plan to get it'll be later this year that the book's coming out, and you're going to come back and talk to us in greater detail about the book and spoil the end and all that stuff. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm full of spoilers.
You see how I worked that all into one thing?
Yeah, I did. It was very deft.
better to do it that way. Well, PJ, always great talking to you. Thanks so much for being with us, and best of luck to you with the Philip K. Dick and with the publication of the new book.
Thank you so much, guys. It's been a pleasure.
Stephen, I believe our music this evening is Piano Jam by, is it Kygo? Is that right?
Yeah, Kylo. That's right. Piano Jam from Kylo.
All right. Piano Jam. Well, thanks, Stephen, for setting that up for us. Thank you all for being with us. We will be back again next week with another all-new show. And until next time, live to see it.